It's Wednesday and time for our weekly discussion of the latest in state politics with the Dakota Political Junkies. Joining the program today is John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. And John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carl.
Also with us is Jonathan Ellis, reporter and columnist for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. And Jonathan, thanks for joining us at the last minute.
How do you do it, Carl?
Well, lawmakers are now past the midway point for the 2015 session. Things are getting a little bit more interesting. There was a controversial bill to increase the number of signatures needed to bring initiatives and referendums, and that was tabled by the State Senate Affairs Committee last Friday. The prime sponsor of the bill, Corey Brown, expressed disappointment that the decision, or rather the discussion, couldn't go forward. And John Hunter, looking at that discussion, why was the bill tabled? Why couldn't the discussion go forward?
Well, there was, I think, a lot more negative public feedback about that bill, and it was, you know, the opponents framed it probably well, you know, just to say this is beating down democracy, this is against South Dakota's history, which has a long history of referring measures and initiating members and so on. So I think, I just think there was so much public backlash against it. I don't think Corey had any choice but to remove the bill.
Well, Jonathan, looking at this bill, the opponents had their say. What was it that was behind this bill? What was the reason for proposing this?
Well, there's a lot of speculation about that. You know, some people have thought looking back at some ballot measures that have passed. And by the way, historically, we're kind of in a period of time where we've seen more ballot measures than in other periods of history, so they're kind of a popular outlet right now. There have been periods of time where we've gone decades without having them, so this is just historically a popular time for these measures. You know, some people have wanted to look back at the most recent election and say, well, you know, maybe this is a reaction to minimum wage or something like that. I think, though, it probably had to do with, this is speculation on my part, because, you know, this didn't go forward, so we didn't have a discussion about what was really motivating this, but I suspect it may have had to do with, we have Steve Hickey, a Republican lawmaker, and Steve Hildebrand, who was a longtime political operative who worked for the president, have both expressed interest potentially in a measure that would cap interest rates. And so I suspect that, you know, if there was a motivation behind that, that perhaps, you know, payday lenders or some others who would maybe oppose that, might have been involved. It might have been a factor in this effort that, of course, now is tabled. That might explain one reason why, you know, there was an emergency clause put in, because, you know, that would, in an effort to try to make it more difficult for them to bring that to a statewide vote in the next election.
And what was the emergency clause? What does that mean?
Emergency clause means it goes into effect immediately. And most bills typically don't go into effect until July 1st, but an emergency clause, they go into effect immediately after they've been signed by the governor. It's a higher bar, however, to pass a bill with an emergency clause. I believe you need two-thirds in both the House and Senate to do that. So it's a higher bar, but if you can get them passed immediately, if you can get it passed, then they go into effect right away.
John Hunter, what are your thoughts on what was maybe behind this bill?
Well, I think Jonathan's right in the fact that we've had a few more recently. So I think there's just maybe a concern. I'm just speculating also that there was a concern that this would be essentially a new way of legislating, that people, instead of going through traditional legislative and governor processes, that they would merely take these their issues to the ballot and kind of skip all that. And if there's a low threshold for getting things on the ballot, that there would be more and more of these. You know, in other states, however, I mean, when we lived in California, there could be 30 of these things on the ballot, which I think is a bit excessive. And California, I think, discovered that as well. But I think it's just a concern that that things would be would usurp the normal legislative process.
Jonathan Ellis, do you think Corey Brown and the other supporters of this bill were surprised by the vehement opposition to it?
Well, they shouldn't have been. I mean, it wasn't something that they were publicizing by any means. But, you know, as soon as, you know, word got out, it was quite remarkable to me how this issue penetrated among regular people. I mean, a lot of people who maybe don't necessarily take, you know, much stock in what the legislature is doing. There were people; those people were aware of this issue and felt like it was, you know, the legislature's attempt to deprive them somewhat of their voice. So it really penetrated the population more so than a lot of other issues do. And so I thought that was interesting. And, you know, I think that I just think that it was politically that you could see that this was something that would be a mistake. I mean, I'm frankly surprised that Corey Brown, whether you agree with the fact that maybe the bar is too low or not. I mean, it's just not a politically winning issue.
I think Corey Brown was even saying that there were opponents calling in to and swearing at the pages. Do you think that was, you know, I suppose we have no idea how many people actually called in.
Yeah, let me just say I'm somewhat skeptical of that. Maybe one person called in and used a bat. I don't know. I mean, I'd like if there are pages out there cussed at, go ahead and call. I mean, there's widespread skepticism about how much of that happened. I can tell you this though. I mean, lawmakers are using it at our coffee here on Saturday. Ernie Otten and Deb Peters and some of the others, I think, were saying how deplorable it was that people were calling in and cussing it as if this, you know, hundreds of people were doing this. I have my doubts. Let's put it that way.
John Hunter, do you have doubts?
Yes, I do. You know, but it's not that it didn't happen, but again, it was probably in maybe one instance or it's possible more. So I don't think that's a big trend or anything.
Will we see any? I mean, it was tabled, but will this come up again, John Hunter?
I kind of don't think so. Unless there is something that happens in a general election that would warrant this kind of discussion and gather more support. For example, if we did have 25 initiatives on the next ballot and people say, whoa, this thing's out of control. But otherwise, I don't think it'll be brought up again.
Yeah, I would add, you know, I mean, there is a place to have, and Corey Brown was, as he's killing this thing, was bemoaning the fact that we can have an intellectual debate about it, he said. I mean, well, let's have an intellectual debate about it. I mean, as John pointed out, in California, and I'm from Colorado, I mean, and I wrote about this in a column. I mean, there have been instances in which voters have enacted measures in other states that are just contradictory. I mean, especially with regard to certain spending issues. I mean, voters say they want money spent here but not here, and they don't want this done. And then pretty soon, lawmakers, their hands are tied. And so, I mean, it is worth having an intellectual conversation about it. It just seems to me that this the way they went about it this way was a little underhanded.
Well, there was sort of connected with this. There was a bill revising the minimum wage ballot initiative passed by voters last year, but that failed in the House. The revision would have allowed the minimum wage to decrease if there was a negative consumer price index. John Hunter, do you think there would have been much of a reaction if this had passed?
Probably, although largely be symbolic. I mean, the likelihood of the consumer price index going down, it's been very, very few times. In fact, I would guess probably none since the early 1930s that you would have seen the consumer price index decrease. But I think there's some symbolism that was this, that look, if you're going to tie the minimum wage to prices, then it should have the ability to both go up and go down when prices change. So I think there was some logic behind it, but I think politically it would be just at odds with something that was just recently passed in November and then in January and February, March of the following year, trying to change it already. I think it's just not what the voters, you know, whether you supported it or not, I think people don't really like their initiatives changed right away.
Jonathan Ellis, if that had gone anywhere, do you think there would have been much outcry?
Well, certainly among the people who sponsored it, the Democrats and labor people probably sponsored it. I don't think, I haven't looked at this in a couple of weeks, but as I recall, it didn't actually go into effect until 2016. And I think that's illegal. Maybe John knows this. I think legally they can't really actually change something until about a year after it's been in place. So it wouldn't have gone into effect this year. There would have been some complaints. The thing about the initiated measure, it's a weaker way to go in terms of if you want to try to get some statewide policy change. You don't need as many signatures to get it on the ballot as you do, for example, the constitutional amendment. And it, give you an example of how changes can be made. I think it was in 2006, if I'm right, that we enacted a bigger tax on cigarettes, and a significant part of that was supposed to go into tobacco cessation programs. Well, fast forward a couple of years, and there's budget problems, and the money that the voters had approved to go to these cessation programs were instead diverted to other places in the general fund. So, the initiative measures can be changed by lawmakers, whereas constitutional amendments are more permanent.
The House approved the repeal of the so-called DASHA law, which prevents a candidate from running for more than one office at a time if one of those offices was for president or vice president. Republicans passed the law 13 years ago, and then-Senator Tom Daschle was a possible Democratic presidential candidate. Now, Republican Senator John Thune has been mentioned as a possible presidential candidate. Republican Steve Hickey voted against the bill, saying the timing was smarmy, and even though a House Republican leader, Brian Gosch, said the DASHA law was bad policy and apologized for it, Democratic leader Spencer Hawley accepted the apology but didn't really buy the timing of the apology. John Hunter, do you buy that? I mean, is this one of those things that's just pure politics on the surface, and there's no getting around that?
Well, first, I like the word smarmy. I don't really exactly know what it means, but it just kind of sounds not very good. But yes, I think there is some politics to that, and partisan politics, let's say. And again, Republicans sponsoring something when Senator Daschle was considered that, and now Republicans considering repealing that when it's possible that Senator Thune would do that. But I don't know. I mean, the states across the country are mixed on this issue. So some states have this and some don't. And they do change now and then, occasionally due to the popularity of a candidate who may do that. But I'm just not sure if that would be a popular or unpopular thing right now. I think it has the possibility of getting through the legislature, but the timing of this, when you have specific candidates right in front of it, it does seem a little bit partisan.
Jonathan Ellis, is that the way it looks like to you?
To me, I mean, when they first did this in, what was it, 2002? I wrote it was in 2002, I believe. When they first did this, I mean, that was clearly an exercise of sort of raw political power by the majority party in the state. And, and what they're doing now, I mean, it seems to me it's less so, I suppose. I mean, and as John said, that states kind of vary on these issues. But, I think Democrats probably are justified in feeling a little bit like, this is sort of another element of political hypocrisy. I think as Bob Mercer, I think, wrote, I mean, there aren't a lot of maybe only a few lawmakers left who are serving now who were actually in the legislature back then. So, the ones who are sort of behind the effort now to get this repealed, I mean, they can kind of do it. They sort of have clean hands on the issue. I mean, they weren't involved in the original exercise of this pure political power, which was a power play, which was just an attempt to sort of stick it to Daschle.
There was testimony in the Senate State Affairs Committee this morning on a measure that would repeal the death penalty. The main sponsors of the bill are Republican Steve Hickey and Democrat Bernie Hunhoff, and also two former Republican attorneys general, Mark Meyer Henry and Roger Tellinghuisen, were scheduled to testify in favor of the repeal. Given that there is some Republican support there, do you think that John Hunter has any impact on this bill moving forward?
I do. I believe the testimony of both Mark Meyer Henry and Roger Tellinghuisen will have an effect on this. I think people will listen to that testimony or did. I didn't hear it, but I think that adds a big measure to it, rather than just being a bill that happens to be sponsored by both a prominent Republican and a prominent Democrat. So, yes, I do think it'll have an impact on that bill.
Jonathan Ellis, you think it'll have an impact?
Well, I believe, and I wasn't covering it, but I believe it was actually killed this morning.
Okay.
but I'm not positive. We have another reporter who, right before actually we came on, I think they had the vote. So we want to check. But I think it's been killed. I think that having the two former attorney generals, you know, does add some weight to the bill. But I think that also, you know, the majority of lawmakers are still in favor of the death penalty. I mean, this basically identical bill with both the attorney generals, Meyer Henry and Tellingson, were killed. Or, you know, they did this last year, and that bill was also killed. I try to find some polling on the death penalty in South Dakota, and it's been a while since we've polled it. I believe it was in 2006, and it was still 61% of South Dakotans backed the death penalty in rare instances. So, maybe that softened somewhat, but I would suspect that if, you know, you ran a poll again, you'd probably get a pretty decent majority of people who, think the death penalty should be used in rare circumstances.
Even if this bill was killed this morning, and we'll find out more about that, so stay tuned to South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Do you think, Jonathan Ellis, that this will continue to be under discussion?
I think it certainly will be, because, I mean, it has been for a while. I mean, the reason why it's been interesting the last couple of years is because of Steve Hickey's presence. I mean, before that, it was generally a Democratic effort, but, you know, with Steve Hickey, with two former attorney generals, I mean, it's one of these issues that for it to be successful, it's going to take a long-term effort and to change sort of people's minds. And Governor Dugard, I mean, as recently as 2012, I mean, had an opportunity to potentially stop some executions, and he said that he supports it then. So even if it had passed, I'm not sure that then it would have gotten past the governor's desk.
On Monday, the House State Affairs Committee voted to pass a measure that would allow people in South Dakota to carry a concealed pistol without a permit. John Hunter, I don't know if you've looked at this bill much, wondering what the reasoning is behind it.
Yeah, it is actually a bit of mystery, other than I think South Dakota, again, still considers, some South Dakotans consider this to be a libertarian type opportunity, and that if you're opposed to gun control, then go all the way with your opposition. And so, but I don't think it's going to gather. I can't predict that anymore, I guess, how these things are going to go. But I would guess it's really mostly a libertarian, and for those people in favor of or against gun control, this is another way of demonstrating that.
Jonathan Ellis, your thoughts?
It's something that I think the National Rifle Association supports. Again, historically, we had this effort, I believe, in 2013. I think it was Lance Russell who sponsored that bill, had a chance. It was defeated fairly narrowly. You know, you have a sort of split between, as John points out, sort of a libertarian element, which says, you know, hey, there's a Second Amendment. Why does a county sheriff, I don't see in the Second Amendment a county sheriff saying that I have to be approved to carry a pistol. So you have that element. And then you have sort of more of the maybe law and order Republicans, and there are some law enforcement concerns with this bill. And so, you know, that's kind of where the split has been. And again, I don't know if it did pass the legislature, then, you know, which side the governor would be on. I suspect he would probably be somewhat sympathetic to law enforcement concerns.
Yeah, well, finally, moving away from the legislature, in his campaign finance report, Senator Mike Rounds ended the 2014 campaign in debt. And Jonathan Ellis, I know that you wrote about this. What happened here?
Well, you know, he spent about $5 million, which is a little bit north of $5 million, and I think he had raised about $4.8 million. And it's not unusual for campaigns to end with some debt. And frankly, to end with $136,000, I think, in debt, which was what they reported for a senator, especially in some of the committees that he's on. I mean, he's not going to have an issue erasing that debt. The interesting thing, though, was that he, you know, a year and a half prior to that, you know, when in summer of 2013, I mean, he was the one saying he was going to raise $9 million. And clearly, he didn't get there. So only raised about half of what he had anticipated raising, and that, you know, and his inability to raise that $9 million really sort of made him seem vulnerable, and it was one of the reasons why, you know, Democratic super PACs came into the state in October to see if they could try to chip away at Mike Rounds and see if they could maybe pull an upset here.
But in the end, John Hunter, more or less, he had pretty much what he needed in his bank account then to win?
Well, it's interesting, I think, too, that both Rick Weiland and Larry Pressler also ended that in debt, too. Then, in fact, have been kind of modestly trying to raise money to do that, to repay that debt, which is, well, I mean, it's not, as Jonathan was saying, it's not uncommon to have some debt at the end, but to kind of actively fundraise for a long time after the campaign is a little bit unique. Sometimes, though, and I would guess that's the situation in at least two of these three candidates, is that the candidate themselves is the person who loaned the money to the campaign, and so they're essentially trying to repay the money that they chipped into the campaign. And I haven't looked at the detail in the report, but that is more common. And then if there's some point at which the fundraising dries up, then the candidate just considers that his contribution to the campaign rather than a loan.
All right. Well, that'll have to do it for the Dakota Political Junkies this week. John, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Carl.
And Jonathan, thanks for your time as well.
Thanks.